Gary Greenberg writes in his new book, Manufacturing Depression, that his first bout of depression began back in 1987 when his marriage was falling apart. He was 30 years old, a practicing psychotherapist, and a doctoral student at the time. His book questions whether depression, his own or others, is a disease that should be treated by drugs or is a natural reaction to loss and sadness. In the book, Greenberg takes on Peter Kramer, the author of Listening to Prozac, and he takes on cognitive behavioral therapy. Gary Greenberg joins us to talk about his personal struggles and his concerns that we are medicalizing unhappiness. And Gary Greenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Well, let's begin with you and begin with this experience or this incident that happened in 1987 that you write about in your book. Could you describe that particular moment?
Well, the moment that I describe in the book is a moment when I actually didn't think of myself as sick, but mostly because it wasn't the vogue to do so yet, because it was in the it was before 1990. And it was a moment when, sort of in the aftermath of a pretty ugly divorce, I found myself, relatively speaking, incapacitated. I was still functioning. I was still sort of dragging myself to work and getting my work done. I was still a student at the time, but I was pretty much out of it and spending a lot of the time, I describe in the book, lying on the floor, looking up at dust specks floating through the sunlight.
I mean, it sounds like you were depressed.
I was depressed.
And you were depressed because of the loss of this marriage?
Yeah, I was 30 years old, and a lot of things tend to culminate in people's lives at various developmental milestones. And so there I was, you know, wondering what I was doing and why, and also wondering in the specifics of it, you know, how I had managed to make such a big mistake and create so much pain in my life and the lives of some other people.
Did you go into therapy?
I was already in therapy.
Was it helpful?
Yes, it was helpful. It was helpful in many ways. It focused me on questions that I needed to focus on, and it helped me clarify some answers.
So did it make you less depressed or lift some of the feelings of suffering that you were having?
Sooner or later. I mean, I struggled on and off. You know, again, it's all retrospective. At the time, I didn't really identify myself as a depressed person struggling to get undepressed. You know, I just identified myself as somebody who was having difficulties in his life, and in particular areas, especially my love life. And after a while of struggling and various approaches to it, I got past that.
What happened then in the 1990s, and this is in part what your book is about, but help us understand, I guess, the various trends and forces that were at work within the field of psychotherapy and within the field of depression.
Well, the biggest thing that happened is the one that everybody knows about, which is that a second generation of antidepressant medications came on the market. These drugs, the first of them was Prozac. It became very famous, sort of a household name. And that drug, for two reasons, I think, at least two reasons, became very popular and very widely used, I should say. And the first reason was that it had, as what appeared to be side effects, it changed people's personalities. And Peter Kramer wrote about this quite trenchantly and very articulately in a book that came out in the early 90s called Listening to Prozac.
Indeed.
And in this book, he detailed the way that people who were being treated for depression would take the drug, usually Prozac, because that was the only one out at the time, and discover that not only did their depression lift, but suddenly things that we didn't at the time normally associate with depression, confidence, rejection, insensitivity, and so on. Rejection, sensitivity, and so on. These things got better as they took the drug. And he talked about what the implications of that were in a way that made it seem like it wasn't such a bad idea to take drugs to accomplish that goal. The second thing that happened was that the pharmaceutical industry was evolving to a point that these drugs, the new antidepressants, were quite clearly capable of becoming their cash cows. And they were quite ingenious and sort of relentless about making sure that they could milk them.
I do know people that take antidepressants. I don't know whether it's Prozac or exactly what it is that they're what they take. And what they describe to me, and this is a bit of an overgeneralization, but that these drugs provide a floor that they know they're not going to sink under. But it also provides a ceiling, and it sort of compresses, I guess, the kind of moods that they might have sort of within this floor and ceiling. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think the spatial metaphor works really well. I think that's exactly the experience that many people report. Another way that people put the same idea is that they, and then this is a slightly more disturbing description, is that they find that they don't react as strongly to the things that are going on around them, in terms of both sad or unhappy events and events that might bring them joy. So the top and the bottom, as your metaphor implies, are gone. Mm-hmm. And the result is at least a glimmering of a feeling of numbness. I don't want to overstate that. I don't think that these drugs numb you out the same way that some other drugs we have at our disposal do, but there's no question that calling them so what drugs is not, at least it's not slanderous toward the drugs. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of accurate.
And what they also have described to me is that they do feel better and they do function better. And, you know, yes, they may not have those joyous highs, but they don't have that sort of deep dog of depression that so many people describe. In fact, you know, you describe in your book as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think anybody should begrudge another person their experience of improvement with the drugs, because why would anybody wish suffering on anybody else?
Sure. You're a psychotherapist. You're not a psychiatrist, so I guess you can't directly prescribe medication. But are there patients that you've worked with where you feel like they do need some kind of Prozac or some kind of antidepressant?
Well, need is a funny word in that context, so I'm going to skip over that word and just say that it's. I work with plenty of people who are taking the drugs, and I have personally recommended that they go and do that in many cases. I almost always, in a case where somebody not only is depressed but is suffering from an unhappiness that is hampering them, I always remind them of the option, and I always talk with them in quite a great deal of depth. And I think you'd be surprised, given my book, how objective I am about it. You know, I have a very open mind about using these drugs. I'm much more concerned with whether or not a person thinks he's sick than whether or not a person is taking drugs. I think that the question of whether or not you think of yourself as sick may be even more important than the question of whether or not you're taking drugs, because I think it changes the nature of the drug taking. It changes perhaps even the experience of the drug taking.
Well, let me segue then to 2006, and again, you write about this, where you were part of a drug trial at Massachusetts General Hospital, and they diagnosed you with, you know, a serious mental illness.
Yes, they did, and you would think that I would be somebody that being labeled that way, given my experience in this field and so on, wouldn't have a profound effect. But I have to say that it's pretty powerful medicine when a doctor tells you you've got a mental illness.
Mm. And this was based on what, some tests?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very well-constructed, very highly validated test that is tied to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM of the American Psychiatric Association. And it's just a series of questions that it works like a troubleshooting chart. You know, if you have this problem, then you go down to this place, and if you don't have that problem, then you go to the next place on the page. And through the series of questions, the doctor ascertained that I qualify for the diagnosis of major depression.
Right. Which is a pretty serious diagnosis.
Well, I mean, is it? It used to be.
Well, you know.
It used to be a serious diagnosis. It certainly is set out as one. If you read the DSM closely, you know, the level of impairment is supposed to be pretty high in major depression. But at the same time, we don't really, you know, what's in the DSM and what we actually have in reality can be quite different.
And I don't want to give too much of your book away. Nonetheless, you do participate in this trial. And what did you learn?
Well, I learned in the course of doing the trial, I learned that you get a lot of help from the doctors in constructing your experience. So when you're asked questions repeatedly, because the way the trial works is that you go up there every... I was going to Boston, which is about 80 miles from where I live, and I'd go up there every other week and take the same tests, be asked the same questions over and over again, and after a while, you begin to think that, for instance, one of the questions was, are you feeling unusually self-critical? And suddenly you start to wonder, well, is being self-critical part of an illness? Is it a symptom? Rather than just my style, or for that matter, what makes me a competent writer or a competent therapist. And so what happens is that slowly, or maybe not so slowly, your idea of what's wrong with you and who you should be when you're cured is shaped by these questions. It's a sort of a second-order placebo effect.
So when millions of people in this country are either diagnosed with depression or call themselves depressed, what's your concern about that?
My concern about that is that it's one thing to describe yourself as depressed. I think in 1987, in the incident we were describing, if somebody said, are you depressed? I would say, oh, yeah. But it's another thing to say, I have an illness like diabetes. And while I am sure that it is possible for people, and not just possible, but it is the case that there are people whose depressions arise sort of spontaneously and cruelly from the accidents of their biochemistry. There's no question that that's got to be the case in some situations. For the most part, I think we do ourselves a disservice if we dismiss these powerful feelings of unhappiness, of discontent, and the insights that they bring. I think we do ourselves a disservice by dismissing them as the symptoms of an illness, which is to say, to dismiss them as random and meaningless.
And we're about a minute away from our first break here, but you're saying it's important to understand the distinction between the sort of biochemistry of depression and the kind of existential questions and experiences that we have just because we're human beings?
I think that's right. You know, I don't know that I'm capable, or at this point anybody's capable, of actually showing you where that line is drawn. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, the line is in danger of disappearing entirely.
And what do we lose if...
Well, as an example, we lose the ability to be critical of the world around us, or to take our own criticism seriously, because one of the things that happens with depression is that we become pessimistic. And it's possible, if you think your pessimism is the symptom of an illness, to simply dismiss it, whereas pessimism might be the thing that allows you to say, something's wrong here, maybe I should do something about it.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Gary Greenberg is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a psychotherapist and a writer, and his new book, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, is called Manufacturing Depression, and it's subtitled The Secret History of a Modern Disease. We're going to take a very short break, pick up on our conversation, talk about pessimism and a whole host of other things that he includes in his book, and take calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University School of Law supports WHYY. Widener University School of Law offers numerous specialization opportunities. Widener Law's MJ in Corporate and Business Law is designed for those seeking graduate-level training in legal analysis and regulatory compliance for a corporate, business, nonprofit, or government environment. A March 24th open house in Wilmington will provide details. Registration at 302-477-2704.
You hear it all throughout much of the music being released today. The electronic beats and the perfect plastic pop of the early 80s. It's better known as synth pop, and we'll explore this influential genre this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Arden Theatre Company supports WHYY and presents William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet now through April 11th. It's an opportunity to rediscover the tale of pure passion between the children of sworn enemies. On a simple stage, this visceral production celebrates the language and indelible characters of Shakespeare's masterpiece at the Arden. Romeo and Juliet tickets are available by phone 215-922-1122 or online at ardentheatre.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with psychotherapist and author Gary Greenberg, and his new book, Manufacturing Depression, examines how sadness became labeled as a disease that could be medicated, something that concerns him. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let's pick up on pessimism, which we were talking about right before the break. And how does pessimism serve us?
Well, one of the bases of criticizing, for instance, a social order is recognizing that there's something wrong with it. And I think there's a good argument to be made that you can't do that without your emotional apparatus intact. So, if there's a problem out there, the way you know it's a problem is that it bothers you. And to the extent that that problem, social problem, is hard to solve, it may bother you more. Let's take, for a ridiculous example, let's take global climate change.
Okay.
That's the kind of thing where it's important to be pessimistic, because if you're not pessimistic, you might overlook the necessity, absolute necessity of acting. Or let's take another example, which might be less ridiculous. Let's take the global economic meltdown. Here's a story, I mean, this new book, which I haven't read, by Michael Lewis, that comes out, is about people who took their pessimism seriously and made a gazillion dollars because they noticed that there was something really wrong out there. And they transformed that recognition into a position in the market that allowed them to make a lot of money when the bubble finally broke. Well, I'm not sure that that's the solution, but I do know that the problem, the one about the market being about the bubble in the market, was something that you couldn't see if you insisted on being optimistic.
Are you saying, or are you concerned that then we confuse pessimism with depression, or we call it depression, or someone has a depressive personality?
I would just say that the instruments that we use to determine what depression is are incapable of distinguishing between those states which are created, those states of unhappiness, let's call it, that are created by people's actual experience, and those states of unhappiness which arise according to the contours of a classical disease where something goes wrong in your body and the next thing you know you have diabetes or you have cancer or you have depression. The tests that we have simply are unable to distinguish. And so you run the risk, and I think that this has been borne out in the epidemiology of it, you run the risk of over-identifying, what they call false positives. Too many people fall under the diagnostic rubric because we know, for instance, that depression is indistinguishable from mourning. We know that depression is indistinguishable from the reaction that one gets when one is unemployed, when one has a divorce. We know this, that you cannot distinguish one from the other.
We have gotten, I guess, like a lot of radio shows or a lot of programs, books about happiness. We seem to be in this sort of trend of trying to understand happiness or try to figure out how to make ourselves happy. And I wonder what you make of this trend that seems to be alive. And it's an interesting trend in a time of such difficulty.
Well, let's remember that the trend toward happiness actually occurred during the period of irrational exuberance. I'm sorry, toward happiness studies occurred during the period of irrational exuberance. I mean, it's now, I would say that we're seeing, this is sort of the leading edge. We've just seen a whole series of books, including mine, about what might be wrong with the overdiagnosis of people as unhappy. But to the extent that people were interested in that question and writing about it, I think that there's been a real tendency to try to square our experience of life as a difficult passage with our notion that we should always be happy. And people easily become confused and upset and even despairing about the discrepancy between the way that they're living and the difficulties of living today and the happiness that supposedly is the point of being alive. And so I think there's a great opening for people like Dan Gilbert to write a book about stumbling on happiness and how, it's there when you're not looking for it. Or down there in Philadelphia, Martin Seligman's whole body of work on learned optimism and authentic happiness, and trying to help us understand how we don't have to live with that gap between how what we're supposed to have and what we do have. I would look at it the other way. I would say, well, if there's such a gap, then maybe we should look at the conditions that make it so and question what's going on that would create an expectation that could leave so many of us so unhappy.
But this is a more personal question, but so do you think about your happiness or depression, or am I happy today? Am I happy now? Am I depressed? I mean, is that one way that you sort of evaluate your life?
No.
Or your day-to-day existence?
Very rarely. If I'm miserable, I know it. If I'm happy, I know it. But it's not like I spend my days thinking that, I should be at a 9 and I'm only at a 7.
Like taking your temperature every day.
Yeah,
or
I mean,
all the time.
And I think that too many people are encouraged to do that and to mm-hmm. see happiness, whatever that is, as some kind of an achievement or some kind of a virtue that they ought to achieve. I'm much more concerned than with questions about, like, whether or not the people in my life that I love are okay, and whether they're treating me well, and whether we're getting somewhere.
Speaking of Philadelphia, you also have a lot of criticisms, I would say, with cognitive behavioral therapy, it's headquartered here in Philadelphia. And I'll just pull out a couple of words that you use to describe this as a, quote, method of indoctrination into the pieties of American optimism. And there's more that you say about it, but what do you mean by that?
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy, I mean, look, first of all, every therapist uses some of these techniques all the time, because right. basically, in its most general sense, it's about reasoning with people. You know, we spend our days trying to reason with people. But cognitive therapy takes it an additional step and tries to inculcate in people the notion that they are capable of seeing the world exactly as it is, and the world exactly as it is a benevolent place. Which is, you know, that's a belief, and it's a legitimate belief, but it's a belief. It's not a fact, and yet it's presented as a fact. It's also the belief that underlies American optimism, the idea that, you know, it's a belief that underlies manifest destiny. So when I took the training course in cognitive therapy, I didn't know what to expect, and I was taken with how openly this was. You know, this is an ideology of optimism, and I thought that was very interesting.
But you're saying, from your perspective, the world is a malevolent place?
I don't think we know. I think what I'm writing in this book, and people will have found this frustrating, I don't really come down on one side or the other. I say that we don't know. It certainly can't be proven scientifically that, A, we ought to be happy, or B, that happiness comes from from a particular set of practices, or conversely, that when we're depressed, we're sick. We simply don't know. These are not questions that science is really designed to answer. And yet, using the rhetoric of science, it's very easy to make it seem like you do know. So, no, I don't know the answer to that question.
I'm curious, as a psychotherapist, and as you mentioned, and I think it's true, that good psychotherapists use a whole bunch of different techniques depending on their patient and depending on what's going on in that patient's life. But I'm curious how you would describe the kind of therapy that you do.
Well, I'll defer to the New Yorker on that one. They called me an existentialist humanist psychotherapist, and, you know, I never really put it together before, but I think they're probably right. I mean, I think that it's about the confrontation with existence, and that what by and large causes people the kind of suffering that they have when they come into my office is that they're having trouble facing whatever it is that life is bringing them. And so what I did in the book and what I do in therapy are very similar, in that I try simply to get whatever the situation is opened up in as expansive a way as possible in order for people to see what their situation is. That's why I took the approach in the book that I did of telling all of these stories about how we got to this point. Because doing that, I think people get to really see the history that they're embedded in when they go to their doctor and their doctor says, well, you're depressed, here's a drug.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get you to talk about your experience with ecstasy, because it was a very interesting part of the book. Gary Greenberg is our guest. He is a practicing psychotherapist and author of a new book called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. And the book is in part about himself, but it's also a look, a critical look at the drug industry, the prescriptions of Prozac and other drugs to deal with depression, and raising a whole host of what I would describe as existential questions about suffering and optimism. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I have to say, Gary Greenberg, I really enjoyed the section on ecstasy, because it seemed so personal.
You read the section on ecstasy?
I did.
Oh.
Well, of course.
Okay.
I mean, is that okay with
you? Yeah, great.
No, I thought it was fascinating, because here you are. I mean, you're very open to your own life and some of your own struggles, and you describe actually taking ecstasy with a woman who did become your second wife, and the I don't know, breakthrough, that there was something that happened that was so dramatic as you and she were lying in bed together.
Yes, and are we talking about that now?
We are talking about that now. Yes,
yeah, that's fine. I thought maybe you had to take a break.
So, No.
We at the end of this depressive period that we were talking about earlier, I didn't know it would be the end, because of things that I'd heard about this drug, ecstasy, and its effect on relationships and its effect on people's mental outlook. I took ecstasy with my wife, my current wife. She was not my wife then. And we had an experience, and the sort of the point of it for me was that when the drug kicked in, I happened to be looking at her, and our eyes met, and in a moment, my entire experience of being depressed, which had lasted for a couple of years at that point, just went away. It was, you know, it was a miracle cure. And even at the time, although I was, you know, stoked to the gills on a drug, I didn't attribute it to the drug. I attributed it to her and to the relationship that I had with her. And suddenly it was possible for me to see through the filter of my depression. And it really just, it changed my life. It also, I have to say, gave me a long break from my depression. It was years before I ever felt anything approaching that level of unhappiness again for any kind of prolonged period.
So do you think it was the drug? Do you think it was your wife? Do you think it was the chemistry and love that you felt at that moment?
All of those things. I think that, you know, obviously it was a drug, and the drug, interestingly, is a serotonin drug.
Yeah,
just,
exactly.
Just like Prozac is. So obviously there's something going on, and we have no idea what it is, with serotonin metabolism. It could be the serotonin itself. We like to think of it that way, but as time goes on, it becomes less and less likely that it's as simple as, you know, a deficiency or an excess of serotonin. But whatever is going on in the brain makes an experience possible. Mm-hmm. That in my case was salutary. It was life-saving, I think, or at least it was relationship-saving. So I don't have any illusion that any conscious experience is possible without brain chemicals. And I had this experience where my brain chemicals were tweaked in a way that allowed me to have an experience that changed my life. So I consider myself very lucky in that respect. And that's why my book does not take a position against using drugs.
Right, right.
If I had been given the drug to cure an illness, right. If somebody said to me, here, take this drug, it will cure an illness, I don't know what the outcome would have been.
Well, let me quote you, because I actually thought it was such a lovely passage in so many ways, but you write, in one moment, and this is really just to underscore what you just said, you write, a nanosecond maybe, the dread, the self-loathing, the sadness and despair and nausea, all the dark twisted thoughts that have black-dogged me for two solid years and then I'm moving down here, it all drains away, every last polluted ounce, I feel it leave me like dirt washed off in a shower, I don't know where it has gone, and I don't care. And I mean, that is a description of what happened at that moment?
That's exactly what happened at that moment. It's one of those flashbulb memories of what psychologists call it, you know, where you just remember something so vividly.
So have you taken ecstasy again?
A couple of times since then, but it's not the kind of drug that anybody wants to take a lot. It has serious neurotoxic implications that mean that not that they're so bad that you shouldn't use it, but you have to be very careful. And frankly, I never needed it again.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, when you took it again, did you have that same kind of intensity of experience that you just described?
Yeah, I think the quality of the experience is a lot the same, but it didn't have the same meaning because I wasn't in the same situation. I mean, you have this intense openness to the world that means that you want to be very careful where you are and what your circumstances are, but the actual effect of it and the meaning of it will depend on the context and what's going on at that moment. And I think this, you know, this is a valid pharmacological model that we have not explored yet, whether it's for depression or other suffering, that one of the reasons that drugs like ecstasy, and by the way, ecstasy had a reputation for this, so did LSD, so did psilocybin. They've all been researched in this way, very small research, but still showing that this kind of thing can happen. And, of course, it's totally divergent from the pharmaceutical model where you want to, the ideal thing from the drug company's point of view is taking a drug every day for the rest of your life.
And in this instance, for you anyway, this was this life-changing event that happened, as you describe, in a nanosecond.
Yes, and I think that's the kernel of that, of the experience of these kind of this class of drugs, the psychedelic drugs, is that you have these universe in a nutshell revelations. And frankly, how many of those can you stand in a lifetime?
You describe the drug industry, the depression industry.
Say it again.
The depression industry?
Yes, I call it the depression industry.
Because
in my book.
Yes. Because it, you get the diagnosis and then you get the pill and then you're on the pill.
Well, I call it an industry because it is. I mean, it's an industry built around depression. There's this human experience, and around it gets built for lots of different reasons and through lots of different channels. Around it gets built an industry.
And for someone with a, let's say, a chronic condition like diabetes, is there the equivalent industry that deals with them?
Sure, there's a diabetes industry. There's a total infrastructure for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The type 2 diabetes infrastructure is a little more complex,
right.
But yeah.
And for people that are taking medication, what do you want them to think about?
I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that I want them to think about. First of all, I want them to think about the possibility that if the drug is working for them, that it doesn't necessarily mean they were sick to begin with, which changes the question of what do you do when you realize that you're more or less dependent on a drug for a kind of experience in your life, for a particular mood or for a particular way of feeling. You know, if you're told that this is like insulin for a diabetic, then maybe you never even think about stopping. If you're told something different, which is this is a drug that gives you an experience that is very powerful and very salutary in lots of ways, but you might not be able to have this experience without the drug, then you make an existential choice. You decide, okay, I'll live my life with this. Or you say, you know what, maybe I won't. Maybe I'll persist through all of the discomfort and all of the trouble that it involves to get off of these drugs, especially if you've been on them for a long time. So that I don't have to be dependent on a doctor and a drug company and a pharmacy and my insurance company to have my everyday experience of life.
Let's take a very short break, and then we will get some callers in on the conversation. Gary Greenberg is our guest. He's a practicing psychotherapist, and we're talking about his new book called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Christiana Care Center for Advanced Joint Replacement supports WHYY and wants to help you live a pain-free, active life. Located in Wilmington, just off I-95, the center offers comprehensive programs for hip and knee replacement. Their surgeons perform all the 1,600 total hip and knee replacements conducted annually. The Center for Advanced Joint Replacement at Christiana Care is dedicated to helping patients get back to living their life fully. More information available online at christianacare.org.
Ben Stiller was an action star in Tropic Thunder, which he wrote and directed, and played a self-involved male model in Zoolander.
I was thinking about volunteering to help teach underprivileged children to learn how to read. And just thinking about it was the most rewarding experience I've ever had.
He's now starring in the new film, Greenberg. Ben Stiller on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Digital technology is shaping how we work, socialize, even how we think.
Sometimes I feel addicted to technology on a day-to-day basis. I think in some ways it gives me a little shot of energy to move away from a task, but there are times when I have to decide. I'm turning everything off.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Join me for the next Voices in the Family when we find out if technology is actually changing how our minds work. That's today at noon here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Gary Greenberg. He's a psychotherapist, treats patients, and has struggled with bouts of depression during periods of his life, something that he writes about in his new book, Manufacturing Depression. He's also come to question the diagnosis and the common use of prescription drugs, and the book is part memoir, part history, part critique about the risks of pathologizing sadness. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-94. Let me get Candace from St. David's to join our conversation. And Candace, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, I do view my depression as a woman. I'm speaking for myself as more of a chronic physical illness, like chronic diabetes, more so than a mental illness. And I guess that's because so much of my major depressive episodes are linked directly to changes in my menstrual cycle. So it's very hormonal for me. Although I did suffer with depression as a child, as I've gotten older, I've noticed that I will usually have bouts with it when it's around that time.
Yeah.
And so for me, there's still such a stigma attached to mental illness, which is ridiculous in 2010. But I had to admit that I am more able to deal with the fact that I need to take medication for what I view as a physical illness than having to take medication for something that's a mental illness that maybe I should have more self-will or, you know, more power, more faith to be able to deal with this mental issue. The other thing that I find very interesting as a student nurse, I'm in nursing school right now, and I found it very interesting, the DSM classification of depression as a mental illness. But when it comes to things like postpartum depression, where it's the same situation where hormones are a big part of what's causing the depression, I don't believe that postpartum depression is classified as a mental illness.
That's interesting.
So for me, I choose to accept, okay, I have a physical thing going on with my hormones that makes me crazy every month, and this is how I choose to deal with it.
Well, Candace, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You put a number of issues on the table, and I want to give our guests a chance to respond. Gary Greenberg, your thoughts as Candace described her own situation.
I just think Candace gave a great description of something that we haven't had a chance to talk about very much, but that I think is really important, which is that one of the values of calling depression a disease is that, or anything a disease for that matter, is that it definitely increases the amount of sympathy available for the people who suffer from the problem. This is, I think, the benevolent impulse behind diseasing so much of our suffering. And I don't say that with any irony. I think that's really important. I think there are probably better ways, but that the way our society works to get sympathy for your plight, particularly if it has to do with questions, roughly speaking, of pleasure and pain, you're best off having a bona fide disease. Now, I think the tail is wagging the dog a little bit on the depression end, but I think Candace put it really well. She says she chooses to think of it that way.
Right.
Well, good for her. It works for her. And I don't have any problem with that because it sounds like she's sort of thought about it and struggled with it. And this is what she's come to. I think it's also interesting to consider the comparison with diabetes, because diabetes, type 2 diabetes I'm talking about now, which is the kind that's acquired during life and generally is a, you know, some kind of vulnerability compounded by lifestyle changes, sedentary lifestyle, food, and so on. This is a disease that we also think of as an internal chronic illness, but that clearly has social implications. People who are diabetic are often people who are living in the inner city. Why? Because there's not very good food in the inner city. There's no supermarkets. And so on. I could point to a number of social factors in type 2 diabetes. And what I'm getting at is that at some point we have to decide
if we're only going to limit the disease label to those things that we identify as having an internal biochemical cause. Because if that's what we're going to do, then we're going to see more and more of this kind of disease mongering that we've been seeing over the last 10 or 15 years. As opposed to saying, okay, if we do the surveys and we do the studies, we discover that some sizable percentage of the American people are unhappy enough to qualify for the diagnosis of depression. Now, maybe there's something in the water. You know, maybe it's an epidemic that's caused like a, you know, like every other biomedical illness. But maybe there's a problem out there in the world. And so I think that it's important to understand that the disease label only points us to the fact that there's suffering that needs to be relieved.
And the kind of disease mongering you're talking about is the kind of stigma that, that Candace referred to, the idea that if you're struggling with, we'll say, depression, since that's what we're talking about, there's some point at which either you caused it or that you can't be trusted because you have it.
Well, actually, I'm sorry, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's not exactly what I meant. By disease mongering, I mean when the drug industry, it's usually the drug industry, turns a kind of suffering, you know, restless leg syndrome is probably the best example, when a kind of suffering is turned into a disease. And that way people are then entitled to the benefits that go with being a patient, as opposed to a crazy person or a malingerer or a lazy person or something like that.
Well, I notice in your book you write a lot about Job.
Job, yes.
You identify with Job and his suffering?
I don't exactly identify with him. I mean, everybody, I think, at some point in their life, you know, when the troubles happen in threes, they begin to feel like Job. But I certainly know people who remind me of Job, and I think that Job was in exactly that position where the one that Candace describes, where a person is suffering, you know, and you can't deny their suffering. But in the book of Job, what happens is that he's comforted by a series of elders who try to convince him one way or the other that his suffering is really his own fault. That while bad things have happened to him, he's wrong to go around thinking that life is really rigged against him, which is highly ironic, because anybody reading the book knows that indeed, that's exactly what happened to Job. He was played in a dice game between God and Satan, and yet his comforters are telling him that the problem is all inside him. And I think that this is a lot of what happens in the depression industry, is that people are convinced that their unhappiness resides in a molecule inside them, so there's nothing they can do about it except take the drugs.
Let me get Candace, thanks for the call. Let me get Christina from, or Christina, I should say, from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Christine, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to mention my own experience taking Celexa for about 9 months after I ended a 13-year relationship, and I feel like it was really positive. I feel like, you know, my family support combined with traditional therapy and also what I sort of viewed as a very, I guess I would say, responsible role by my family physician, in, you know, kind of monitoring my progress and, you know, also, I guess, in response to what you were just describing, my own expectation that I wanted to feel better and I didn't want to be on medication for the rest of my life. I think that's just part of my own, you know, I have a mother who's ill and I feel she really identifies with her disease or that her disease identifies her. But, you know, I thought I wanted to come off of it sooner, and my doctor actually advised that I stay on it for 9 months because in his reading, he, you know, stated that I guess after 9 months, a patient's less likely to relapse, et cetera. So, you know, I came off of it gradually, and I feel good.
Well, you know, Christine, another very interesting story. Let me give our guest, Gary Greenberg, a chance to respond to that. And again, I'm just curious what you say back to Christine.
I say that, you know, let's take away the doctor and the disease. And let's just look at Christine as somebody who's just had a major blow in her life, and she's feeling bad. And there's a remedy out there that can help her feel better. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
I don't know that this should be restricted simply to the antidepressants.
And it sounds to me like Christine's husband, doctor, didn't, try to sell her that she had a lifelong illness, although he did tell her that, you know, she needed it for a little longer, and of course that's a completely unverifiable statement. Nobody really knows. But it sounds like she had a really good experience with this drug. And to me, that's, you know, this is inarguable. That's why there's such a market for these drugs, is because people take them and they feel better.
Christine, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Gary Greenberg, you also describe what you have done, and this is to live your life and to feel like you're not going to be dragged down, as you had described in that previous section in the book. How do you deal with your own existential anxiety?
Well, you know, it depends on the day. I mean, as I get older, I've come to take it with much more of a grain of salt. It doesn't bother me as much for some reason. Maybe it's the body's natural Prozac, I don't know. But, you know, I find consistently the trick for me is to engage myself outside myself, to find something to engage myself with, whether it's writing or, I play music or friends or a project, you know, something that pulls me out of myself. Now, for people who are, you know, severely depressed, that's virtually impossible. But I would say that is the minority of people who have the symptoms of depression.
And the idea is that I guess once you become so internal, you can. I mean, for people who are severely depressed, that's it seems to me a condition in and of itself. But for those people that are borderline, the depression, I guess, can make you very. I don't want to say self-absorbed.
Yeah, you could say self-absorbed.
Okay, I mean,
I'd say that's right. It's like a
well, I mean, that sounds like such a harsh judgment. But
well,
then,
but you know, sometimes you know, there's a wonderful short story by David Foster Wallace, a famous depressed person,
called
The Depressed Person, and he's obviously writing from experience, although he deflects it and makes his main character a woman, he has nailed that experience of being self-absorbed and sort of clueless about the extent of your self-absorption and the toll that it's taking on other people. And I think that there are people for whom knowing that doesn't help, and there are other people for whom knowing it is a real spur to doing something different. And I'm not in the business of saying who is who. I'm just saying that is one thing that people can do.
I do want to get back to our callers, but you can't see this, Gary Greenberg, but it looks like everyone waiting on the line is a woman. Does that surprise you?
Not really. I mean, I've been doing enough of this to know that that's generally who we hear from when it comes to the subject, and in general, the emotional difficulties of living in our particular world are differentially affect women. Mm-hmm. I mean, women suffer a disproportion of it, and of course, women are much more willing to talk about it.
Well, let's see what Donna has to say. Donna from Chester Springs joining us on Radio Times. Donna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was listening to the comments about diabetes, and with diabetes, certainly you can test for blood sugar levels. And I was wondering, are there tests being developed, whether blood tests or brain scans, that might determine if someone's brain chemicals or hormone levels are low or if their brain function is inadequate?
Well, in a nutshell, you want me to answer that, right?
Yes, I do.
In a nutshell, sort of. There's one test that's been done for many years called dexamethasone suppression test, which is essentially a test looking at the endocrine system. And that correlates pretty well with the kind of depression called melancholia, which is close to the kind that we've been talking about here. But the bigger answer to the question is no, and the reason for that, I believe, is because depression is heterogeneous. There are many paths to the same experience. Saying somebody's depressed is like saying they have heart or that they have chest pain. It doesn't really tell you very much except for about their affect. I'd also add, so let's say we come up with this test. What are we going to do with it? Mm. Should the people who don't pass the test not get Prozac? I mean, to me, this is a great example of what's wrong with this whole setup. The people who take the drugs and feel better, they didn't need to pass the test in the first place. In fact, what you have is a population of people out there who were severely depressed who show up on the studies as benefiting from the drugs. And this is the big news a couple of months ago that,
you know, the drugs only help really severely depressed people, but that's not true. There's a whole bunch of mildly depressed people out there that are benefiting from the drugs, but the tests don't test for the ways in which they're benefiting. So those people, whatever the test is, they probably wouldn't pass it, but should they be denied the drugs?
Mm.
I mean, and I don't want to sound like an advocate for them, but this is the problem here is that we have a great deal of trouble with people sort of seeming to take shortcuts around pain in this society. And while I'm not on the side of pain, on the other hand, I think it's worth considering whether or not we should be so, we should have to create an entire industry in order to make it okay for people to take drugs to feel better.
And we're almost out of time here, but would you also say, and I think you're saying this as well, or might be embedded in what you're saying, is that we both over and under prescribe antidepressants?
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think they're probably under prescribed to the severely depressed for reasons of stigma or access to health care or money or something like that. And I think that they may be overprescribed in the mildly depressed people, especially the ones who discover after a year or so on the drug, unlike the caller Christine, that they can't get off them. And then they're really stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So they may be overprescribed, but that also may be the case that we just need, there may be other drugs that could be used in the same situation that wouldn't create that problem.
Well, Gary Greenberg, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It was my pleasure.
And our pleasure as well. And he is a psychotherapist, and his new book is called Manufacturing Depression, and it's subtitled The Secret History of a Modern Disease. And we appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program. Also, join us on Facebook. And on our Facebook page, we take our fans, as you are called, inside some of the workings of Radio Times. And you can, of course, also follow us on Twitter. And Bob Purdick, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the program is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.